the romper room part of the exercise here. Let's go around the room and introduce yourself, and hopefully that'll give Christopher a chance to arrive. I guess by way of introduction, this is the implementation advisory group for the soon-to-be-formulated review team on consumer trust, confidence, and no choice, and competition. So we're going to have an exciting time. We're going to start with Michael Graham.
Michael Graham from IPC.
Margie Milam, ICANN staff.
Krista Taylor, .tba.
Karen Lentz, ICANN staff.
Steve DelBianco, business constituency.
Jonathan Zook, chair from ACT and the IPC.
Judy Song Marshall, Newstar.
Mason Cole with Donuts and the Registry Stakeholder Group.
Phil Buckham from Dollar Vice.
Rudy Van Snick, ANPOC.
I'll just fill in. Christopher Wilkinson, at large, member of the CCTLD board, and other things.
Excellent. Welcome, everyone. It's always good to have these face-to-face meetings. On the phone, it's a very different kind of dynamic. We are on the home stretch in terms of creating a set of recommendations for the review team, and so I'm very excited about that, and I thank you to all for all the work that we've been doing thus far. So we have a few new metrics that were suggested by Krista, by Christopher, and one by Ron that we want to go over. But I think the meat of this particular meeting, I think we'll spend most of our time on, is talking about the economic study and some of the questions surrounding that, because I think that needs to get out to the world, that RFP needs to get out to the world sooner rather than later and get that baseline economic study started. So what I'd like to do is hand the talking stick over to Aliza to talk us through the document that we got from the consultants on the economic study and to raise the issues that we need to discuss to finalize that RFP. Aliza, can you, who I guess hasn't introduced herself, so introduce yourself first and then take it away.
Hi, thanks, Jonathan. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. This is Aliza Agopian from ICANN staff. So the report we received was actually from for the consumer survey, not for the economic study. We've contracted with NORC, the National Opinion Research Center, to do a scoping analysis, basically to help us set out some of the technical parameters for an RFP to choose a survey firm, as well as help guide us through some of the language on sampling and things like that. I think I don't have control of the slides, so whoever does, Charlotte, perhaps, can you scroll down to the next slide? Thank you. So I sent around these documents on Monday, and the other one that we're going to talk about later, as Jonathan mentioned, is the new metrics and some staff feedback we have on those. So I wanted to start off on the RFP. Our goal is to get the RFP published on July 16th. So to that end, we are trying to get some feedback to NORC to make any adjustments to their report or to ask them to give us a little more detail on some items within the week. So I was hoping to focus today a bit on talking about that. And of course, if you guys have any other additional comments, you're welcome to email them to me. So in the slides here, I've highlighted some of the bit larger questions that I highlighted in the document I sent on Monday. So I wanted to start off with the first one here, which is the question of potential registrants. We had talked about in our last call last Wednesday, the difficulty of measuring potential users, and I think the question came up as to whether potential registrants would be a possible sample set. NORC NORC suggested against that, or NORC, I guess I should call them, given the cost of identifying that group and the potential for change over time and then trying to capture that change over time. So I wanted to get the group's feeling on that recommendation first.
Elisa, this is Jonathan. So we talked a little bit about this, I think, in the email. Just to refine this question a little bit, is NORC is not suggesting that if we didn't look for potential registrants, we wouldn't end up with them. It's more that we wouldn't be able to have an identifiable subset of potential registrants. Is that the issue? Because this is just consumers writ large, many of whom could be potential
right.
registrants. So the question is, I know we made that part of the definition for consumer when we were looking at the consumer trust piece of this, but if we're not actively excluding them, we should probably, we'll end up getting some of them. I guess the question is, it's too much of an effort to try and identify them as a distinct carve-out or cross-tab within the study. Is that the issue?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head. Basically, it would be really difficult to sample it in any sort of accurate way.
Yeah, of course.
Steve DelBianco, a question about that. If they were conducting a survey and they get hold of a respondent, I'm fairly certain they could ask the respondent, you know, are you a registrant? Yes, no. And maybe the next question says, have you considered, and would you consider, are you actively considering becoming a registrant of a domain name in order to discover that they're what we would call a potential and not a current registrant, and that allows you to ask some rich questions about whether they trust the registration system and they feel like they have adequate choice among appropriate top-level domains. So what I just said seems so sensible that I wonder why NORC, who are the experts, think they can't ask it that way.
The statistical significance of the group that would be identified. I think the issue is that, as a statistician, they're concerned that when I go out and ask that question, I can ask it and we'll know who answered it a certain way, but then we might not end up with a statistically significant sample of people that identify themselves as potential registrants without a specific effort to continue doing the research until there is a statistically significant sample.
That's a very helpful answer, and it sounds like we're just managing expectations here. We'll ask the question on who's a potential registrant, and we'll keep track of it, but in managing expectations, we should not assume that we'll find a statistically significant number of them to draw conclusions about potential registrants.
I think that's exactly what they're saying.
And if I could also add, I think there's also a question of measuring change over time. How are you going to measure whether they decided to later become a registrant if you're using sampling designs where you're asking different samples, the same questions again in a year? It's going to be hard to measure how they changed their minds. So that's another consideration.
Christopher and then Michael.
I think, Jonathan, the essential has been said. I have to balance my policy interest in knowing what potential registrants think and my economic and statistical sense as to what is feasible. And I think you just summed it up correctly. I don't think we can... I think we can get some interesting color, right, but I don't think we can get statistically significant results from trying to chase up... potential registrants. I think it's so let's move on. That's one less problem to deal with.
Michael?
Yeah, I was just going to say along with Steve that it seems that we've put the answer ahead of the question, and that if they're asking the question, we may or may not come up with a statistically significant group. So in terms of setting this aside and saying we're going to go after this particular group, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's see what the survey would find.
No, Michael, you're exactly right. And Steve, you're exactly right. We will ask the question and probably branch the survey based on the answer to that question. And I think we want to continue to do that. It's just often when you contract with a company to perform a survey, if you suggest you want a statistically significant sample of a particular subset of your population, then they will keep doing the survey until they've found enough people that identify that way to be statistically significant. And I think they're suggesting, that could get very expensive, if they only represent a 0.5% or something of the people that are going to respond to the survey, then you're going to end up serving a lot more people to get there. So we may, by accident, get there. And I think so we'll construct the survey with those kinds of questions, but we won't put in as a requirement. I think that's really the issue, that we find a statistically significant sample of potential registrants.
Jonathan, I have two comments from Mike Nelson in the Adobe chat room.
Who's Mike Nelson?
And he doesn't have audio, so he can't respond to that comment.
Oh, darn. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
He said it certainly makes sense. Well, he just typed some more. Certainly makes sense. Even worse than trying to identify potential voters. How potential? We can really... We'll keep typing. Hold on just a second. We can really reliably determine if someone has registered a domain name.
Right.
We agree, Michael. Thank you for your comment. So I think we're in Marcy, did you want to say something?
Yeah, Nidra, in what Nork had suggested, that might be where they were headed, is that it's really easy to identify a registrant via Whois records, but, you know, is probably the cost of, you know, what approach they intend to seek in order to get the information, and, you know, they wouldn't be able to use Whois for that. They'd have to find some other method.
Yeah, there wouldn't be a method other than just asking enough people until they answered that way. So I think we're in agreement on that first question. Let's move on to the next one, unless, Elisa, you came away with any confusion about where we stood.
Well, it sounds like we can ask about who might be a potential registrant and then move on if we don't have a ballot and a sample. Did I get that right?
That's right. I think we asked the question, and then there's probably a couple of questions we ask those people that self-identify that way, but we're not making it a requirement to come up with a statistically significant sample of potential registrants. So we'll get color from this, as Christopher put it. Steve.
Okay.
Margie just said something about Whois is a good place to go to get actual registrants. And that's throwing me, because this survey is going to include people that are not registrants, right? Because users are part of the population. It's registrants and users. So we already know that the survey vendor is going to be surveying earthlings, some of whom, all of whom are
right.
Users, and some of whom will say, I'm also a registrant. Right. Some will say I'm a potential registrant.
Well, but Steve, you actually raised the same question. Because in our definition of consumer we included registrants as well, a potential survey team might figure out that they want to come up with a statistically significant sample of registrants, and the way to do that would be to randomly go through Whois as opposed to randomly going through consumers.
Okay.
And so given that's fairly easy to do, we might still have them do that. That was Margie's point.
Got it.
Go ahead, Elisa. It'll get easier from here.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that. On metric 2.1, we're asking how to measure how frequently users deploy tools that hide URLs. This gets back to metric 5.2 to 5.4, which asks us to measure the how frequently those tools are being used using market data and whatnot. NORC, in responding to this metric, recommended that if we wanted to use this as a metric of trust, sorry, I'm getting a lot of feedback. This is really hard to hear.
We can hear you fine, though, just so you know.
Okay, I think I'm just hearing your speakers in the room. So in order to use this as a metric of trust, they also raise the point that it's important to include how familiar people are. So I wanted to get familiar there with your tools like QR codes, URL shorteners, and so forth. So I wanted to raise this issue in the context of 5.2 to 5.4, which we've talked about in the past, which are listed in our list as measures of trust. And we had discussed last week and I think the week before about maybe categorizing those as issues with choice. I thought they raised an interesting point here and wanted to discuss it with the group.
Yeah, I've had some conversations with Evan about these metrics and whether they fall under trust or choice. And certainly the ALAC, when they put together the metrics, believed that they were part of trust. But others have suggested they might be part of choice. And so I my guess is that in order, the only way to use them as a function of trust would be to incorporate that question into this survey. And so I don't know whether or not I don't know whether or not I agree with NORC that we need to really explore in depth their understanding of these tools, because what we're really doing is asking if they're using them, and if they aren't, and if they are, asking why. And again, I don't think that we're going to necessarily get to a statistically significant subsample of people that say that, but instead get some color around the notion of, if you're using alternatives to the DNS, why are you using them? I think is just meant potentially to inform the review team that there's more to look into when looking at the paid for data sites, and maybe even make a decision whether to get those data sets at the time. So I don't know that we need to go through a whole process with them, but instead ask if they're using them, because if they don't know what they are, then they're not using them.
But I think the point is that to gauge their feelings about trust in the DNS, if that's what the metric is supposed to gauge, and you're just asking them if they're using them, that still doesn't get to, do they trust the DNS or not?
There's a follow-up question. So if you're using them, then we ask why.
With multiple.
Right.
Answer.
I'm sorry, was that not what...
So my point is that we don't need to find out how familiar they are with them. It's more why they're using them, that's all. That'd be the follow-up question.
Do you use one? Okay. If so, why?
Does that make sense?
I thought I heard speaking off the microphone.
Yeah, but he wasn't saying anything particularly new.
Oh, okay. I thought you were asking me about that comment. Yeah.
They don't call me the hammer for nothing. So yes, it's a two-stop question. Do you use them? No. Move on. Yes. Why are you using them? Multiple choice question that help, again, hopefully provide some color that suggests that they're using them for some random reason, or potentially because they have lost some faith in the DNS. Okay?
Okay. All right. The next questions I have were on survey design, and the NORC report gets into this in far more detail. So I've really just given you the Reader's Digest version here, but they talk about longitudinal versus cross-sectional design. So longitudinal, in very, very short terms, they will sample the same group over time, versus a cross-sectional design, which would sample two different groups. And will be less likely to be indicative of changes in attitude. NORC kind of leans toward a longitudinal design recommendation in their analysis, and presents some good arguments as to why cross-sectional design might be problematic, particularly because we need to measure change in attitude over time. So I wondered if the group had been able to read those sections, and if you had any thoughts or comments on that.
We've had some discussion about that, and when the consultants from Greenberg came on, there was some discussion of both of those approaches, and there's pros and cons to both of them. I felt like where we ended up was actually allowing that to be part of the responses to the RFP, to get recommendations from the folks that are bidding the proposal out. I don't know that there's a definitive answer between the two of them. One is a more focused group-oriented approach where you try to go back, and you have to grossly oversample in order to accomplish that, because you lose people over time. And then the cross-sectional one obviously has a risk of people just having a different set of opinions to begin with. So, I mean, neither one of them is going to be perfect. And I think that where we had landed was to let the survey proposals make suggestions and justifications for their approach, and then make the analysis at that time.
Okay. I mean, I would agree with that. I think that's the most logical approach, because I think we might get the best range of responses in the bids.
You can build into the RFP that if they suggest a methodology that they should justify it so that we're given some criteria to compare them, and that would probably be useful. Steve, go ahead.
In the RFP, that if they believe there are two potential approaches, that they could price them out separately. So give us the opportunity to pick.
And I've already written that into the RFP. So, yeah, we've asked them to give us alternative approaches with pricing.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments on that one? All right, and then there's also a recommendation in there. It's not so much a I guess they lean toward a web survey versus in-person or phone interviews, which kind of present their own challenges, particularly in terms of getting good samples, particularly in countries where there may not be good phone lists or good address lists. I guess the question I had for the group is, and I'm guessing I'm going to get the same answer here, is should we express a preference, or do you see this as, once again, being a question of seeing what the best proposal offers?
This is Jonathan again for the record, and I'm personally inclined toward, once again, putting it in the hands of the proposals to make recommendations. This is also a topic that came up in the conversation with the consultant, and the pros and cons of both of these approaches came up, and obviously the problem with web surveys is sample bias, and but the other issue that came up that was kind of interesting is that it may actually require different approaches in different geographical regions. In other words, there are some areas in which the web penetration, et cetera, is not even good enough to use for a survey. So I suggest that an ultimate proposal that's has multiple geographic regions may even be a mix of these two methodologies. And so we should, again, leave that to the proposals to sell us on the best approach to getting this done. Steve.
This is the detailed report that was attached to Elisa's email on page 11 is where the NORC is asking this question about the four different modes. And in there, they said the largest challenge is to identify or compile suitable sampling frames for drawing internet end users. They say it's unlikely that any countries are going to have a comprehensive list of internet end users from which to draw representative samples. So that indicates it's all going to be a push survey, as opposed to relying upon people to answer an ad. Have you already been down this path and discussed that it had to be a push survey with a targeted individuals identified from some other list versus soliciting the populace of that nation? Please click here to survey, and then we discover about you.
Both of those methods came up in the brief discussions that we had. Obviously, we had an hour and a half, and we were talking about, and one of the issues that came up was that distinction. But one of the things that I recall, and again, my recollection could be imperfect, was that the best approach would vary, actually, from geographic region to geographic region. And so that there probably isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all solution to this. Was again, the opinion of one consultant, which are probably in some ways equivalent to NORC. So, I mean, we now have two conflicting kind of approaches, but I'm inclined to put the RFP out and get people, again, to justify how it is they think they would approach it. That's my inclination, but I'm not trying to impose that. Does anyone else have any comments about it? I'm just remembering the conversation about it.
This is Steve. Thanks for that answer, and that sounds right. I support that. With respect to the question that's on the screen, though, I too would be inclined to say that web survey is our default method as opposed to mail and in-person and phone. I don't know why we would, being ICANN, do it any other way.
I mean, the danger sometimes is one of self-selection. That's all. With webs, you know, answering an ad, going and doing a survey. So,
but some of the online surveys would be as a result of doing targeted outbound emails based off of lists.
That's exactly right.
In both cases, it's a web survey.
That's right.
One is self-selected, the other's picked. So, in terms of the tool, not the sampling method, but in terms of the tool, they're asking us web survey, And I think that's a slam dunk, right?
Agreed. Unless it's not feasible in a particular area. That's right. The default, the de facto. Did that make sense, Elisa?
Yeah, it does. Natalie was just asking if our budget is flexible. Can we decide anything to pursue any method, no matter what the cost is? We can't pursue any method, that's for sure. The budget is fairly fixed. I think we're basically looking for options that will fit within our approved budget. And that's why we're asking in the RFP for the vendors to give us alternatives with pricing structures so that we could choose the best, most representative bid.
We think web surveys. I think that's right. And web surveys are likely to be the cheapest.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Christopher.
I'm not querying the underlying ideas here, but I just wanted to mention a word of caution, because in certain TLDs, a significant proportion of the registered domains do not lead to a website. There are significant proportions of parked names, names for sale, names which have been registered, but the website is not yet... not yet up, and this is true even for mature domains. And I think with the new domains, we may find that a lot of the domains that are surveyed will be null results in terms of the positive results of the positive result that we're looking for. So that we may have to find them. They may have to survey rather more websites than they expect in order to get down to drill down to a significant number of websites which are actually being used that people will have to. But that was just a cautionary word, and I hope I'm wrong. But I doubt.
Christopher, thank you for your comment. And obviously, in this case, we're surveying people, not websites, and so they may have some experience with disconnected URLs that shows up in their view of the DNS. And that may end up being an interesting factor in the delta of those concerns over time. In other words, seeing if there's a change. So I think hopefully the way this goes down, it will incorporate that potential. All right, what's next, Elisa?
Okay, can we move down to the next slide, please? Thank you. Definitions. So there's a number of definitions that NORC recommends we make clear in plain English in the RFP, and then once a bid is received and accepted, we would then work with the bidder to test it and refine that definition. But I think for the purposes of the RFP, we need to come up with some good plain language definitions. So the first one I noted was consumer trust and consumer choice, and consumer, I should have noted in here as well. We have definitions that came from the GNSO and ALEC from when you started your initial work, I think back in the fall. So I wanted first to talk about those and make sure that we are comfortable with going forward with those, and then we could talk about some of these other terms. And I came up with some quick definitions using as plain of language as I could to define some of these terms. But maybe we could start off with consumer trust and consumer choice, if there were any further comments on those definitions, and I can read them off if that would be helpful.
Both those definitions were hard fought, so if you open that can of worms, I'll have to disconnect your line.
I had a feeling that might be the response, but I just wanted to be sure.
Move on to the other ones.
Okay. The remaining ones, so we have phishing, parking sites, malware, spam. You can see them all up here. I'm not going to read them all off to you. So I went through, I got as many as I could from the ICANN glossary or from the ICANN wiki, some from Wikipedia where I found kind of more basic plain language terms. Spam, I adapted that from Spam House. There's on the next slide, there's a few more terms as well. So maybe we could start with these ones and see if there are any red flags in the language I've used so far.
Sure. Can everyone take a minute and read these four definitions and raise your hand if you think there's some confusion about them or something inaccurate about them?
This is Steve, and I like them all, except I think that parking site, we will have to clarify that. You said without any services. There are people in this industry, and certainly here in London, who would believe that a site that has five or six ads on it leading elsewhere is a parked page, but it provides a service and that it earns pay-per-click revenue while it's waiting for somebody to come by the page. It generates traffic. There's a whole industry of people that do that. So parking sites here is one that is used, I wouldn't say not for services at all, but a parking site without associating it, without any services like email. I don't think that makes any sense. There's plenty of websites that I would take email out of that. And, of course, it is a website if it's a parked page. So we're going to have to rework that definition, I think, to say what are we getting at. And what we were probably getting at is that the registrant didn't populate it with actual content, but rather temporary. That's what park means. It's temporary while it generates a little bit of ad revenue and some traffic, and then later on they'll decide to actually put original content on it.
This is Jonathan. I guess I just want to say quickly that I think that it's wrong to say parking sites anyway. I think it's about park domains, which would in fact include, which would exclude domains that were put up just to do email, right? I mean, so focusing on sites is why you're excluding email, but yeah. I have domains that I own that don't have web pages associated with them, but have email addresses associated with them, and I don't think that's uncommon. Sure. And so I think we need to change that to say parked or parking domains, and then the definition as it's there is closer. And we just need to get at the politics of a web page that's used for just ads. I mean, I guess that's really the question there. Rudy, go ahead.
Yes, Rudy, for the transcript. I think we need to make the distinction in this aspect that where it is impacting the consumer trust, that it is important to know if it's a site or a domain, especially that is set away to disturb the trust of the consumer. Because, as you said, many have a domain name that is just used for email services or even for doing some FTP services that are not public at all. So we need to know where is the distinction about trust and non-trust.
Well, and I don't even know if this was a trust issue as much as it was related to choice and whether they were parked rather than used for defensive purposes.
I can read you. It's 1.4. Metric 1.4 is the only place in our entire document that the word PARK shows up. And it was on a sentence that says this. 1.4, survey perceived consumer trust in the DNS relative to experiences before the GTLD expansion. Survey could at least measure experiences with phishing parking sites, malware, and spam, and confusion about new GTLDs. So the word parking site was just sort of listed among several things that would be assessed in a survey as we try to measure whether people trust the DNS more now after the expansion versus before the expansion. So we don't need a precise definition. We may not even need the term to be used, except to translate it to our survey vendor so they can design questions that that drill into why people trust or don't trust. So Rudy, no need to figure out where this fits. It's just part of the conversation we have with the survey vendor.
Mission in order to, I'll turn it into a question in the survey.
I don't think we do.
Because it's just a list of possible things people might have encountered?
We're trying to direct the survey vendor to measure perceived consumer trust in the DNS. And we wrote in here, the survey could at least measure experiences with. So presumably they design a question that would ask a consumer, now that the expansion has occurred, do you believe there are more web domains that
are useful or something?
Contain only advertising links. I mean, we could potentially give them that vocabulary, because the word parking won't mean anything to the people they're surveying.
Jonathan, Michael here. I do think that we need to have clear definitions, because as we all know, once the results of this are made known, we're going to be asked, how can we rely on this when it is not clear what a parking site is, what fishing is? Whereas if we have the clear definition that we had turned over, I mean, then we answer it. This is what we meant by it. This is what they asked about.
Thanks, Michael. Mason, go ahead.
I agree that for the purpose of the survey, most consumers have no idea what parking means in web terminology. That being said, if it's important to have a definition, maybe we could turn it into what a parking site is instead of stating what it's not at the outset.
So, Rudy, go ahead.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think it would be good if we could ask the survey vendor to use samples, because as we're going to address consumers, not everybody understands even definitions that we are going to put forward. Samples very often are more usable to identify what we think it is, so that they understand the questioning that we are doing. Don't forget that we will probably end up in having non-native English speakers in our replies, and samples are most often, especially when we talk about parking sites, the CEDO sites, we all know how they look. And it could be good that they have a definition that they can say, okay, that's what we understand also as being a parking site, just to give a sample.
Krista.
I think it would also tie into whether it's meaningful, i.e. a park site isn't being, by definition, we'll understand if it is a meaningful site.
Mason.
I got to disagree with you on that one. It may be meaningful to the person who's trying to search out for a specific product or service. And if I go to pizza.com, for example, there may be a list of links for all kinds of pizza places, and that may be potentially valuable for me.
Steve.
Krista read the word meaningful because it was part of what the working group did. 1.4, I read you the sentence on parking. The next line said, confusion about new GTLDs and user experience in reaching meaningful second-level TLDs. And this was a working group a year and a half ago trying to figure out a way to explain what's meant when you assess whether people feel more or less trust. And it goes on to mention, what's your experience like with the new GTLDs? Are you finding that with the new TLDs you're able to reach websites, domains that are more meaningful to you, right? There would be questions like that to try to assess whether the new TLDs are giving them confusion or satisfaction.
Well, if that ship has sailed, that's fine. I mean, you know, we can fix it. Well, okay. All right. Maybe we use a different word.
Or maybe we don't put a value judgment on park sites. I mean, that may be part of the issue. Maybe we just drop it.
I think we drop it.
Because the other things are so much more specifically bad and understandable that we don't need to make a value judgment about whether a site's parked. Go ahead.
Ray Fast, I think you just said it. I think the more we try to head down value judgments, we're heading down slippery slopes that could actually end up distorting what we're trying to aim to achieve.
Lisa, did that make sense? I think we drop parking sites from that particular metric.
Okay.
A while to get there, but we've redefined it as dropped.
Okay, sounds good to me.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think the key is that we're not so much interested in defining precisely what it is, but explaining the idea of, if you have these experiences, how does that rate your trust in the system? So I think you all got to that point in your conversation.
Does anyone else have any comments about the other of the three definitions, or can we move to the next slide?
There's a couple of comments in the chat about spam.
Cheryl? Or just read it out to us, maybe. That's going to be pretty small.
Thank you. The comment in the chat is from Mike Nelson. Says the definition for spam is odd. There is a definition for quote unquote bulk, but we don't use the word elsewhere in the definition. Webopedia definition is cleaner. Spam is electronic junk mail or junk news group postings. Some people define spam even more generally as any unsolicited email.
Just about every email anybody gets from me is unsolicited, so I don't know. But bulk is not defined anywhere and is not mentioned anywhere in the metrics, so maybe it is confusing to add that in there. Yeah, and then go ahead and read Tony's as well. And Natalie agrees with Tony, so I'd like to know what Tony said.
Tony's comment is, for spam, I might simplify to say, quote, commercial email that the recipient has not requested from the sender, unquote. There are varying definitions for spam. In the U.S., generally, in order to be actionable, the spam must also be false/misleading, but for these purposes I would try to simplify, and since non-commercial email can be classified as spam, example political news email, but is generally not considered as problematic for standpoint of abuse of the DNS, I would suggest we limit to commercial.
All right, thoughts? Rudy, go ahead.
Rudy for the transcript. Based on the European definitions, and I think that's one of the big differences, there is the opt-out, opt-in. In Europe it's a opt-in. And we are talking about unwanted messages rather than solicited emails or whatever. Unwanted is a more precise word used in Europe for messages that we call spam.
Anyone else with a thought on that?
This is Aliza. One of the points I wanted to raise that Rudy brought up was that these can all be translated in different ways, which you're absolutely right. And I think an important qualification in the RFP is going to be how you test the definitions cognitively across different languages and cultures. I think this might be one that in particular is very important to test depending on what country you're asking it in. So that may address some of those concerns.
Steve?
Yeah, your point about bulk was correct. The word bulk is never used, so we shouldn't have it defined, number one. The word spam is used twice in our metrics, and we didn't try to attempt to limit it to commercial. And I believe that that would be a mistake, to try to say it's only commercial, because after all, political and a lot of the stuff my mother sends me is spam. But there ought to be a way to measure it. The two words that show up are unsolicited, and Rudy said the word unwanted, and in a survey, exactly, we're in a survey, and the word unsolicited or unwanted, we could use both words as an opportunity. There'll be some false positives there, because people will say, I don't want this email, not remembering, of course, that they opted into getting it when they ordered something from Levi's, and they haven't opted out yet, so they'll still say it's unwanted. It's all a perceptual thing, because we're measuring before and after the new GTLD program. So if they end up saying that since the new GTLD program, I perceive I'm getting more unsolicited or unwanted emails. And that, if you ask the question that way, you don't even need to use the word SPAM. There's no need to define it, and let's just say unsolicited or unwanted email.
Because if we define spam, we'll have to define ham. Christopher.
I suspect that spam is spam in rather a lot of languages. And I know that the ITU is not the flavor of the month in this context, but they have conducted recently extensive studies and policy documents about limiting spam. And so the translation of spam terminology into numerous languages is probably readily available.
And that's a good point. I mean, I guess it could be spam and then a parenthetical of unsolicited or unwanted emails. If you know, I think we can easily do both. I think you're right. It is becoming a very widespread term, like web or something like that. Okay, Aliza?
Okay, sounds good to me. Shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah. More comments from Tony or Michael that we're missing? I think we simplified this way down, so we addressed their concerns. All right, let's move to the next slide.
Okay, so a few more terms here. Second-level domains, cyber squatting, and, of course, GTLDs. You can take a look and let me know if anything jumps out at you.
Christopher.
I have a quibble. It's not entirely internally consistent. Marketable and trademark related, okay. But then I would, at the end of the definition, just say that wished to develop them, because the end of the statement limits it to trademarks, whereas cyber squatting, for example, in geographical terms or other valuable generic terms, cyber squatting does actually extend nowadays way beyond trademarks.
Jonathan, it's Michael. Now, I think I would remove from that the last phrase after trademark-related terms, comma, because the rest of it presumes that they're going to be sold back, and who knows? I mean, it's with the intent of doing that, but that is enough concern, I don't think, in the definition.
And do we need... I mean, that's the thing. Is it trademark related? I mean, is that too narrow? If we get rid of the second half of the sentence and get rid of marketable, is trademark related enough for cyber squatting, or do we need to include some other term that encompasses the other things that Christopher's mentioning? Mason, go ahead.
I guess I don't quite understand, Christopher, about how it would extend to generic terms or to geo terms that don't have trademark protection.
Well, there is experience in the past years of certainly cyber-squatting geographic terms which are not trademarked. And I think if you look at the numbers of bulk registrations that have been reported, and I admit that we're still dealing with hearsay through the press, but I don't think all those names are trademarked. In fact, we've gone to some lengths to clean the trademark abuse out of the cyber-squatting business, but it's not stopped people from bulk registrations of names which they believe to be marketable.
Okay, I agree with you to a certain extent, and I'm no attorney, and with all due respect, I have to disagree with the idea that registering a generic term represents cyber squatting. I think in the U.S. at least, cyber squatting has a specific legal meaning, and that we should stick with that. Investing in a domain name, which I've done myself. I mean, I have I have several generic terms that I've bought over the years. That doesn't make me a cyber squatter. I'm not infringing on a right. In fact, I may develop those names myself at a later time, and I simply want to have them so no one else gets them.
Steve.
When I read the word marketable and trademark related, I read and literally, not or trademark related. So the notion I thought is that this definition related only to trademarks that were marketable. If in fact marketable doesn't mean trademark, then we should take out the word marketable. So Mason, I'm agreeing with you. I think we should strip out the word marketable. Okay. This is only about trademarks.
Ray?
That's pretty much what my comment was going to be. Thank you.
Evan, did you have a comment? And introduce yourself, please.
Sorry. Evan Leibovich, ALEC. My apologies for coming late. I was triple booked. Is there damage to be done simply by stopping the sentence after the words, those names? Just ending it there.
If you take out marketable. Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole marketable and trademark related, I'm not sure. I mean, you could extend this practically anything that's been, you know, any...
Speculating is not squatting.
Sorry?
Speculating is not squatting.
Yeah, speculating is not squatting. But also, I would also caution not to be too U.S. law specific. ICANN is global, and so there's got to be that sensibility in there. Simply because something's related to U.S. law doesn't necessarily means ICANN has to adopt it globally. But in generic terms, I don't have a problem with the sentence, but just the second part of that is clumsy. So just reselling or licensing those names, period.
So, Elisa, I think where we have rough consensus is to drop the term marketable and to end at those names.
Okay.
Karen?
Thanks. This is Karen Lentz, and just a quick time check. We have about 35 minutes left, and I don't want to spend time on this here, but I was just noticing the GTLD's definition I think is outdated. I know it's from the ICANN website, but I think there's references that we have that are more current than that. So just a note to us, Elisa, to update that.
Thank you.
I think we all agree with that definition in principle, so we'll let it be modernized and move on. Any other comments on this, or can we move on? Ray, go ahead.
If you don't mind, I am going to make a comment. This is Ray Fassett. A literal read of how we just landed would mean that if I can just pick a trademark or a famous one, a literal read would mean if Microsoft registers Microsoft.com in order to profit.
This is not owned by somebody else.
Yeah, it's their own. a trademark owner that registers their own name for their own profit could fall within that definition. just pointing that out, not that we have to tweak it and get it perfect today.
Did he put something in the comments?
Mike Nelson in the comment put the definition from Webopedia. Quote, cyber squatting is the act of registering a popular internet address, usually a company name, with the intent of selling it to its rightful owner.
Sounds good. Okay.
Well, only qualification, it's not necessarily a popular internet address. Nobody's got it, so it hasn't been popular until they purchase it.
Oh, popular, yeah, string or...
And I do like, in answer to Ray, I think... Or Evan, where the last portion of that with the intent being then to later resell or license. Yes, Microsoft wants like Microsoft, but to use, not to resell.
Yeah, but the profit. There is the word profit in there. I mean, trademarks are for the benefit of entities to profit at the end of the day.
Then I would take out the comma after terms.
I'm kind of thinking take out the word profit. Get away from the word profit.
I don't see it in there, Ray. Where is
the first line of the
profit by purchasing.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Can you use your microphone?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of discussion going on.
Let me propose one. Cyber squatting is the act of registering an internet address with the intent of selling it to its rightful owner.
An internet address corresponding to trademark term that is selling it to its rightful owner. Right. Rightful owner of a trademark.
Sorry, I like the simplicity of what Steve just said. That short one. Don't have to get into trademarks, because then, I mean, there's common law, there's other regimes or whatever.
No, it just has to be a term. I think it's not just the site doesn't have a rightful owner. It's the underlying term that does, I think. But Krista?
Bad faith intent is the word that I think we're looking for, and we're missing in that. There's some kind of bad faith in there that they're registering these names that's not in the best interest of the company, which ties back to the Microsoft example, because they're not going to go and register their own name with some kind of bad faith in it. They're doing it for their own gain and protection.
Apparently in Spyhook, somebody at Google did that, but Margie.
Yeah, I think it's still a little narrow because you have people will cyber squatting. If you registered a domain name just for the purpose of, say, pay-per-click, and there's trademark and related infringement. In other words, they may not necessarily have an intent to sell it to the rightful owner because they might be making money during the registration and perfectly happy with that. So I think you're not choosing a – I think you're being narrow in your approach. I think if you follow along the lines of what's in the UDRP, that's probably what we're trying to get at, you know, and I think bad faith is certainly part of it.
Steve?
To contextualize, the word cybersquatting is used exactly one time in the entire document that we developed, and it's used in the exact same metric. We should always remember to go back to the metric. It's using the same metric we've been discussing for the past half hour, 1.4. It's on the survey. So it's just a long list of experiences we want to tell our survey vendor the kinds of things they want to discover and ask about in the perceptions of the users they reach, registrants. So its definition only has to be good enough to describe it to the survey vendor so that they can design questions to divine whether people think that the new GTLD program is leading to more problems. And it's, why don't we just use a dictionary definition and let the survey vendor decide how to translate that to people?
Steve made a good point. Christopher.
Okay, but in that case, do we need another definition for investment or speculation in names? Because the survey will certainly come up with some registrants who have very large numbers of names for apparently for speculative purposes.
But again, this is just about consumer perceptions of the new GTLD program and whether it's affected their trust of it, which I don't think is the fact that there's a bunch of speculators out there isn't likely to have a direct correlation to trust. It's not in the metrics currently.
Yeah, but in terms of consumer trust, this is one of the factors, because if the consumers discover that large numbers of names on cannot be registered because they've already been registered speculatively, or that they can only acquire them at a premium price because they're being resold, that will certainly affect consumer trust.
Steve?
Speculative does not appear in the entire document, and Christopher, to your point on trust, it's really not trust, it's more to choice. Our definition for choice, which we're bound to, is choice is the range of options available to consumers for domain scripts and languages and for TLDs that offer meaningful choices as to the proposed purpose and integrity of the domain name registrants. This is a GTLD expansion program, not a second-level domain expansion program. So we are asking people in choice, and this is a definition we're bound by, it's a choice of the TLDs that I may pick. I own a bike shop. I couldn't find my name in .com, but I go to .bike and see whether I can find it. So it's a TLD choice, not a second-level domain choice. And speculation is not part of the metrics at all, because you don't speculate in GTLDs. You had to do that a year and a half ago when you applied.
Some might argue that happened, right?
You still are. So the speculation in second-level domains and availability of second-level domains is not part of the survey. It's not part of our mandate at all.
Right. It might affect choice, but I can't find my name in any TLD, I guess, right? Was there any other comments on this? All right, Aliza, let's move on, and I'm going to put it in Steve's hand to circulate something tight on cyber squatting so that we have it to give to the survey vendor. All right?
Okay. Yep.
Let's
keep
going.
Can we move on to the next slide, then?
Charlotte, thank you.
Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about what your final report will look like, since we are hoping to get your recommendations to the board within the next couple of months. So this is what I came up with, basically presenting, obviously, an executive summary and background on how the group came together, how we reviewed each of the metrics, And then talk about the ones, how we prioritize them, the ones where data is available, where baseline data needed to be collected, which we've already done some of, and we talked about that a bit last week, getting the surveys, studies off the ground. And then the remaining metrics, the ones that we either didn't recommend or we raised red flags about, we would discuss, I would present in the report basically what the discussion was surrounding those and the different points of view and some of the conclusions that were reached, and then the proposed new metrics, which I'm hoping we'll still have some time to talk about as well. So I wanted to share that outline with you, see if that seemed appropriate. And on the next slide, we can talk a little bit about a timeline.
I think that report format seems appropriate. I think what we'll want to do, though, when we construct this, and I'm happy to work with you, on structure once we get close to it, is to make sure that our actual recommendations, and this might just be the executive summary, are easy to find, and we're creating a product which is most consumable by the review team when it convenes, and that all of the back and forth and everything like that is appendix to that. I think we want to deliver as crisp a product as possible to the review team. So that would be my only caveat in this structure. And so it all depends on what an executive summary looks like, but I would like to make sure that the recommendations, as they finally survive this apocalyptic process, come out looking clean and useful so the review team can dive right into them.
I would agree. Can we go to the next slide? We can talk about the timeline. So this is kind of what I had in mind, is by the near the end of July, 25th of July, post some draft recommendations for public comment. We had this in the original timeline to be done. I think it was in April or May. The public comment reply period would close by the end of August, and we'd post a summary in early September, and then have a draft report ready by mid-September, a second draft ready by early October, and hopefully present the final report to the board by the ICANN meeting in LA in October. This is, I suppose, a bit ambitious, but I think we're far enough along that we can certainly start drafting the report, and I have a lot of your comments and recommendations they could start pulling together. So I think from a staff viewpoint, this is realistic, but wanted to hear your thoughts on it.
Let's do it. Anybody else?
Okay.
Anybody else? Chicken? All right, Steve.
Not chicken at all. Just a question for staff. You know, there's a motion in council today asking staff to explain the sort of status of surveys and review teams. What is the staff's best estimate of when the team would convene, the review team itself would first convene?
So this is Karen Lentz. The affirmation of commitments text provides that the ask us to convene the review team a year after new utilities have been introduced. So using the first delegation date of October 2013, that would put us at October 2014 to be beginning the process of convening the team.
Thanks. Follow-up would be that it turns out there's a lot of work in the community as we designate team members. So I believe looking at the experience of the past four review teams under affirmation, we'd be challenged in the community to name the people and get them all approved by the GAC and board chair by October. So the timing is probably coincident.
Start doing it.
I clarify, I don't think it's a year from introduction. It's a year that new utilities are in operation, and there's different ways of interpreting that. So I just know within staff we've looked at it from different perspectives, and it might be – that's certainly the earliest. But if you start at the very earliest point – the data may not be that useful if you don't have a lot of utilities actually live and experience out there. But there's a council motion today, I believe, on the next steps, and that might drive an earlier review process because obviously you don't want to start the next program without at least having started some of this work. So,
but has staff or the board, has anybody started the process of asking the community to begin naming team members?
No, that hasn't started yet. I mean, Karen, does that make sense?
So I just wanted to add relation to this as well. So, no, the process to actually convene the review team, there's been no action taken on that. I mentioned the date October, and we have looked at, as you alluded to, there's a whole process for actually, seeking submissions from the community and convening the review team, which looking at the past is typically a 3-month process. So our target for, the earliest that we'd need to have data to be giving to somebody would be January 2015, just as a marker.
That's what I remember as well. Mason, go ahead.
Just a question from Margie. Did when you say a year from the when it first goes operational, are you talking about, excuse me, the first day that the first IDN went into the root, or the first day of sunrise, or the first day of general
availability? That's the problem. The AOC is really vague on that. So how is it interpreted? And there's different, there's different ways of looking at it. I mean, the earliest for sure could be the October, the very first date. And the question is there enough data and, experience yet to be able to conduct a meaningful review? So those are all issues that are being sorted. But clearly, if the GNSO, for example, is pushing that, then we probably have to move sooner rather than later. And it would be, could be as early as January, as Karen suggests.
Well, that would still be the beginning of the convening of it, as opposed to the first meeting or the mm-hmm. beginning of formation could happen in October.
Well, if we get behind, we'll just reinterpret it.
That's exactly right. Well, we want it to be useful. So, any other comments, questions about the schedule? Steve?
When the actual comments come in, and a number of you have done this, it's extremely painful to deal with comments that were well-meant and well-constructed but are completely outside the scope and irrelevant to what we're doing. It is very likely that the comments we'll get won't have any relation to our narrow charter, and that's going to be a huge challenge for us to maintain discipline, politely deal with the comments, and get this thing finished. And we'll need to remember the narrow mandate the board gave us, as well as the fact that all we're doing is we were refining the metrics, and we were not starting over.
Yeah. I'm for somebody that's a big advocate of public participation and openness, putting a public comment period on this interim phase already feels egregious in some respects, but... Well, as Steve said, we'll have to. I don't know what would be involved in skipping it, but
the board resolution call for this.
No, it had work with the. I should check to make sure it doesn't. But I recall it saying the this group should work with the GNSO and ALEC and staff. To work on feasibility and make recommendations. The timeline, proposed timeline that I inherited when I joined this team had a set of steps that included a public comment period. So I kind of came in with the assumption that that's what would occur.
I'm inclined to challenge that assumption because our mandate, particularly for this group, is so narrow, and it was all about feasibility and utility and refinement, and we've already received a plethora of comments about the original 70 metrics, et cetera, from which we were working. So the only real delta is going to be these few additional metrics and things like that, and I'm not sure the overhead of a comment period is justified. But, Margie first, then Steve.
Yeah, I think it's a general thing that we do public, or at least the board tends to look for public comment on certain types of issues, but I don't know if this one is one of them, and we could make the choice that the board can decide whether they want a public comment or not and not have the team automatically assume that if that's right. But Karen did inherit that outline. It wasn't, to my knowledge, set in stone.
It's like inheriting debt.
This is Steve. Yeah, let's pretend we didn't see the inheritance and proceed with a plan that doesn't call for it. But that same timeline, we're going to change the timeline. We're going to take out this particular public comment, but we need to make sure that we show it to GNSO and ALAC. That's not in there, and it should be, and the councils. And then let's put in there that when the review team gets put together and approved by the GAC and board chairs, the first thing the review team will do when they come together is develop a charter for their review. And they'll decide which, if any, of all of our hard work they're going to use in the metrics program. You can bet very early in that review team's work, they'll do what? They'll look for public comments on their charter and their review methodology. So virtually all of the metrics, all of our work that survives the review team's scrutiny will then be put out for public comment. So there, this is not eliminating public comment on our work. It's simply deferring it until the body for whom this work is intended makes its decisions and then puts that out for comment.
What subset of it to use? Rudy.
Rudy for the transcript. I'm just wondering, not having full experience with it, could it be that this public comment period, interim comment period, is required due to the fact that there is a substantial amount of money linked to the work that has to be done? Is that, could that be a reason that there is a need before we get this RFPs sent out?
I didn't remember a public comment on the trip to NetMundial.
Okay. Well, so let's not get down that path. The truth of the matter is the board has already approved that. So if there was a need for public comment on that, it would have happened. Evan, do you have something?
Yeah, I'm going to speak in favor of the public comment for one reason, and that's because the nature of what this group has been doing has been culling down the original list of metrics. I think the public comment period would be useful if there's any other members of the community outside of our little team that thinks that any of the metrics that has been left out has been egregiously so. We may come to these conclusions, but if there's members of the community that think they need to be put back, this is where we find out about it. It's not a matter of deferring this to the review team, because the review team will only have to have, their only input is going to be what we give them. So, well, but Steve, what we're doing is we're taking the original metrics and essentially vetting them down, right? So that means that there's some things that are being culled out that other people, that other members of the community may say, no, maybe these shouldn't have been taken out so hastily. That, to me, would be the purpose of a public comment.
I guess I actually agree with you in principle, Evan. I feel, though, that in practice, the actual amount of culling we've done is so minimal that it's not worthy of public comment. I mean, that's literally my impression of going from 70 to 67 metrics isn't something that justifies a public comment at this point. I mean, that's, but in principle, I agree with you. I just don't think we've done anything particularly drastic here. Steve?
And Evan, on calls that you couldn't make, I definitely tried to advocate for even the three that might get called to make sure that we're only calling because we couldn't deliver the metric. Having said that, there are really two wonderful opportunities for you to argue to put back the three. The first is the ALAC and GNSO would both receive this because it's their advice. So it's not a public comment, but it's council and ALAC. And the second is that after the review team begins, if you're not part of the review team, you know that the review team, when it starts, will seek public comment and hold events so they can develop the metrics they're going to use. So those three, you dust them off, you put them right back into the process, into the hands of a review team that is then in a position to make a final decision about proceeding. And they can put them right back. I mean, it's so much more pointed there. Because if we go to the work of public comment and argue to put the three back, you still have to go through the same thing when the review team convenes, because they may decide to ignore 70 out of them, not just three.
Is this an issue? I think we've decided that we will go through a public comment period. That doesn't need to focus specifically on metrics that we have as culled, does it? I think we just have a public comment period.
I think we're trying to sidestep the public comment period and focus instead on going back to the GNSO and the ALAC for amendments to the recommendations and that there isn't enough here in a delta that differentiates itself from the public comment that we've already received on the original metrics to justify a public comment period. I think that's the rough consensus of the room. But Margie?
But to think that through a minute, so you send a communication to the ALAC and the GNSO. I assume you got to give them some time to respond. I mean, you know, they've got a lot on their agenda and won't be able to turn to it so quickly. So, you know, you're going to have to think that through in the timeline, however you land, you know, because you'll probably need some sort of deadline as to when, you know, when you want this to really go to the board and have it be discussed.
Right, so I would suggest that time period is July 25th through August 29th. Michael?
Yeah, Jonathan, could I get some direction just to help? I have been able to speak with representatives of both INTA and the IPC, and the IPC, as you know, there are several members who are pressing independently for some sort of study, which basically this metric might satisfy. But I've not gotten them to a point of stating that they would support carrying it out, that they have a means of doing that. I want to be able to leave this meeting and get back with them and get some very solid proposals from the two organizations. I just wonder if there's a timeline that I can give them that we would like them to look at completing this by, or if we should simply make it an open-ended and ask them when they think they could do it.
I've been part of those conversations inside the IPC too, you haven't gotten a lot of pickup when you've brought it up, but there's a lot going on. I mean, so a deadline would probably help, and I guess I would suggest that the real deadline is about making data available to the review team when that time comes. And so given the amount of time it would take to construct a study, I would suggest that it would probably need to be in that early September time frame. That September 4th date probably is the date by which a decision would need to be made about creating a study that would be relevant to the review team. I think in a sense it's more about creating product the review team might use rather than this team.
Okay, I think that's eminently doable, and as you may or may not know, the new CEO of INTA, Etienne, has been attending the ICANN meeting, and I think based on his experience will be someone to help buy into this, and this is in an area that he's very interested as well.
Steve.
Yeah, you may not have been over the weekend, but the motion that council is considering today on studies, I informed everybody because they'd forgotten, and including Brett, that in May of 2011, GAC advice on new GTLDs asked for an independent review of rights protection mechanisms. So speaking to you about this in the IPC, and it said, in considering how to progress the GAC proposals, the GAC proposes a comprehensive post-launch independent review of the clearinghouse be conducted 1 year after the launch of the 75th new GTLD in the round. They use the word launch, not delegation or operation, whatever that means. So presumably 1 year after the 75th would place you somewhere in January of 2015, and it's supposed to be an independent review, and it should examine, according to the GAC, should examine whether the aims, functionality, and operations of the clearinghouse would benefit from incorporating the current GAC proposals, as well as any unforeseen questions and issues that may arise following the launch of the round. So that's a different review than the affirmation review. Much more narrow in scope, and it will occur sooner, a little bit sooner. And it's supposed to be done by an independent vendor as opposed to the community. Were you aware of that particular one? I'll forward this to you.
No, I wasn't.
I'm going to forward it to you, because that may actually be the review you're looking for in the IPC.
I think Michael's talking about the metrics we had associated with the cost of the new utility program in terms of defensive registrations and things like that.
Costs to the...
to the trademark community.
That's what this is about.
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve, send that to me and let me take a look at it, and I'll work that out with 1.11 and give you what my understanding is of the two.
Thanks, guys. Anything else on the schedule? I think we're going to try to stick to the schedule. I think we're going to skip the public comment period and use that same period for review by the GNSO and ALAC. Can we move on?
Okay. I wanted to talk about the spreadsheet I had sent out on Monday with staff feedback. We don't have very much time left. We can try to go through some of these quickly and then maybe carry the conversation over to email. Sharla, I sent you the spreadsheet. Do you need to share that or share the screen?
Pull it up.
Thank you.
Two pages. I think that fourth column is meant to read Troublemaker 1, Troublemaker 2, and Troublemaker 3, right? Is that the...
So you all have handouts, I believe. I think Karen printed those out for you.
Look for the number 1 in the first column, upper left-hand corner. That's where it starts. One page. It's just one page, front and back. Yeah. So look for the number 1, and that's where we...
Okay. Yeah, it's a little tough to read on the screen, but thankfully you have your printout there. For those of you who are remote, I emailed you this on Monday. So just to go through this quickly, Jonathan had asked me to propose categories for each of these proposed metrics and then do a bit of a value evaluation. I guess I could call that evaluation. So I basically went through it. Some of them were more clear cut. Some of them I think you could argue that they could possibly fall into two categories. We only have about 5 minutes left, so I'm not sure how you'd like to go through this. I could give you a quick summary. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, we probably won't be able to go through this in detail in the next 4 minutes. I thank you for your work on this, Elise. I think it's good work, and I think I read through this, and I thought that a lot of what you wrote here was sensible. I think what I want to do is actually put this back in the hands of the proposers. So, Krista, there's several of these that you proposed, and there's some comments about sort of the causal relationship between some of these things that I'd like you to take some time thinking about rather than us trying to do this in 4 minutes. And the same for Christopher. And let's just try to refine these. And Ron is not even here to defend himself. So I'll deal with him later. But he's over at the NomCom right now trying to do the Lord's work. So the ones at the very bottom, I think, were ones that we'd agreed to sort of on the call together. But the others, mm-hmm. I think, if you guys could respond to them independently via the list, let's not wait till the next call. If you could sort of give feedback on this spreadsheet, that would really be helpful. Is that okay, Christopher?
Yes, that's fine. However, I would like to thank the staff for producing the printout because of the detail was such that it was rather difficult to absorb on the screen.
Right.
Since I've got the floor, my main... The point is not that it shouldn't be in the economic study. I can see the sort of professional economic point about doing that through a study. My point is timing, because I think certain of these aspects are quite critical in the short term, and I don't want to postpone unnecessarily an appreciation by ICANN as to what they should do about it.
Yeah, and so again, we are very short on time, and I know that, Christopher, you've expressed a real interest in the sort of signaling benefits of this this effort, and I'm sympathetic to that, but I also feel like that's outside our remit in large measure to be trying to dictate how individual registries operate. Even though we are making some value judgments on some issues, I think we're looking generally to see how this, you know, is to facilitate the work of the review team, and some of which will in fact feel too late. But if we get the economic study RFP out soon, then I think there will be an opportunity to have what amounts to baseline information. And if it's built into the RFP, that will have some signaling benefit, I think, as well. But do look through these and see if you can answer the questions, because if they are easy to identify data sets that we could collect as metrics, then we can make that happen. So this isn't meant to be a complete dismissal of them from the metrics portion, but let's make sure that we can actually collect data in an efficient way. All right. Thanks everyone for your participation and hard work. As I said, we're on the final sprint here for the finish line. So thank you so much, and I'm very excited about the work we've done, and I think we've made some incredible progress. And I think we will be putting the review team in a good position to make some data-driven analysis, which will be a great change. So thanks everyone, and You guys are going to respond via email prior to the next call, but we'll get the next call shortly. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And you can stop recording the meeting.